meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, have you ever wondered, and I know I do, and especially, you hate to say it, but at this time of the year, how do you argue properly? How do you argue with your spouse and have your spouse listen, or vice versa? You know, is it possible even? There's a new book out called How to Argue, so your spouse will listen. It's written by Sharon Morris May. She's a PhD. And I thought, geez, what better time than right at Christmas? You hate to say it, but a lot of arguments go on during the holidays, and to bring Dr. May on. Hi, Doctor. How are you?
Fine. Thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you on the program. And yeah, I bumbled the intro a little bit here, but I think it's important, and everyone understands that at Christmas, at holiday time, and I'm not just focusing just on those times, but there's a lot of arguments that go on right now, and it's stress, it's emotion, it's whatever you want to call it. What can you tell us about that? And let's get right into the book.
Oh, absolutely. You know, at Christmas time, especially where we're all stressed out, we've got so many deadlines to make and so many things we have to do. And what happens is we usually marry an opposite. If we are fun-loving and easygoing and flexible, we've typically married someone who is more organized and, you know, dots their I's and crosses their T's.
You know, why do we do that? I hate to interrupt you, but you know what? You hit on something that you are 1,000% correct. In fact, it's sending shivers up my spine here right now, because in my relationship, and I'm sure others, why do we do this then? Is there no such thing as two of the same getting married? Maybe not.
Well, you know, some people do, but typically we marry an opposite. An extrovert will marry an introvert, or someone who is more flexible marries someone who is more rigid. And in some strange way, we truly complement each other. The extrovert gets the introvert out and about and expands their world, while the introvert maybe slows the extrovert down, helps them focus and get through life. And we are attracted to each other because we're opposite. But when we get married, the very thing that attracted us to our spouse is the very thing we argue about.
Yeah, exactly. The book is How to Argue. I'll do it right this time. So your spouse will listen. You talk about emotions, vulnerabilities, and dragons that must be dealt with. Let's talk about some of those dragons.
Absolutely. You know, Dana, when we're fighting and arguing over, say, who taking the trash out, most of the time when we're arguing, what we're arguing about is not what we're really arguing about. And we really have to slow ourselves down when we are talking or getting into a heated conversation or complaining with our spouse. And it's really a lost art. Couples are not taught how to argue. I don't think there's a premarital class that says how to argue with your future husband or future wife.
maybe there should be. Yeah, maybe there should be. Absolutely. You know.
Yes.
You talk about getting inside emotions, and emotions can get the best of us. We say things in a snap that we don't mean. Everyone blows their stack, so to speak. We cover a lot of issues here, you know, the very serious domestic violence issues and all that. But I'm talking about a simple argument, like you say,
about domestic violence issues. And if someone feels that they are in an abusive relationship, they really need to go get help, tell someone someone to get help right away. But this is just the common household argument.
Yeah, this is taking out the trash, who's going to, whatever. Let's talk about, you know, and I'm not sure if you cover it in the book or not, but I think it's important, and a lot will say this, not only your spouse, but your children. Once they get to that puberty stage, where you try to get them to make their bed or to, you know, pick up their clothes or whatever, and they want to start an argument. I'm sure the same principles will work with your child as they will with your spouse, or am I wrong?
To a certain extent, yes. I think most of us, when we're working either with our kids or our spouse, we get our emotional brain hijacks our thinking brain.
Yeah, that's true.
And we get stuck in very heated arguments because our emotions take over, and it's the negative emotions. And so we're not just saying, hey, sweetie, take the trash out. I'm getting ready to cook dinner. We're saying, what is wrong with you for not having taken the trash out?
Yeah.
How many times do I have to tell you to take the trash out? And when we use those heated, emotional, negative emotional tone of voice and comments, you know, we think we learn by now, but that negativity does not get our spouse to fall to their knees and say, I am so sorry. You know, when you say take the trash out in 5 minutes, or take the trash out, you mean take it out in 5 minutes, but I think I have the whole day to do it, but I am so sorry. It doesn't. It only triggers defensiveness in our spouse.
Dr. Sharon Morris-May is here with us, and the book is How to Argue So Your Spouse Will Listen. You know, you talk about six practical principles that turn arguments into conversations. We've covered a couple of them, but one I find very fascinating is learn how to complain. That's something I think we all need to know how to do. What do you mean by that?
Absolutely. You know, when we, because we are different in married, and we've married imperfect people, we usually have a legitimate complaint. We have a request. We have a hurt, or we would like our perspective to be heard. And when we are expressing that legitimate complaint, couples usually envelope that complaint with contempt, which says, "What is wrong with you for doing it that way?" And the art of complaining is key to a successful marriage. Being able to slow down, what am I really trying to get my husband to understand or my wife to understand? Do I just want to rag on them, tell them how wrong and bad they are for not doing what I had asked? Or are we truly trying to get them to understand our perspective, understand what we need, and then come to some kind of a compromise?
You know, I was, and the next step that we're going to talk about is probably one of the most important ones, I believe, for anyone in when it comes to sincerity and being able to apologize. And, you know, kids and I were sitting down watching an old episode of Happy Days last night, of all things. And we were watching Fonzie, and Fonzie could never say he was sorry. He would always say, I'm sure, you know, he just couldn't get that word out. But there's more to being apologetic or apologizing than just saying that word, is there not?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, you're so right. As couples, we spend so much time trying to get our point across and trying to determine who's right and who's wrong, that if we feel we are not wrong, or that we didn't do anything wrong, it's hard for us to apologize. And what most couples that I find in my couples intensives that I do with my couples, they will say, I did not mean it the way you took it.
Right.
So I didn't do anything wrong, so I shouldn't have to apologize.
Yeah, right.
Yes, and it's like, sure, you can take that stance, but then you're not going to foster understanding, and you won't be a safe haven, a safe place for your spouse. And so couples really have to, what I say, slow things down and say, if my spouse took it that way, it makes sense they feel this way. Mm-hmm. You know, if my wife or husband took what I said negatively, then of course they then feel hurt or rejected or criticized. And we have to take that position, saying, even though it was not my intention, if that's how they feel, then I have to build understanding and then not say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm wrong, but wow, I am sorry that that is how you feel about that, so that's how you concluded, and for that I am sorry. And it's comforting, really. Because being able to comfort your spouse who is hurt by what you said is very powerful. And you can do it without saying, I am bad, I am wrong.
You know, every argument ends up with making up, and a lot of people will say that's the best part, as far as having an argument, is the making up after. But there's got to be more to it than that, because in an hour, you could be arguing again, and this is why your book, I think, is so important. But one of the steps you talk about is bookend it with good times. What does bookend it with good times mean?
Well, research has shown that if a couple's marriage is speckled with arguments, that when you are not arguing, if you are having a really good, meaningful, connecting times with each other, that actually decreases the intensity of your arguments and is and helps heal the hurts that are accumulated in your arguments. So when you are arguing, just say no to self. For every minute that we are arguing, I have to give 20 minutes of just a nice, sweet, connecting time to rebuild that bond, that connection between you and your spouse. And I find that many couples will argue, sweep it under the rug, and sort of come back together again over house chores. But they don't then come back together and be intentional about having sweet, connecting times together.
You know, you hear so many couples say that once they split up, once they're no longer together, they become better friends than they ever were when they were married and living in the same house together. A lot of people will sit back and scratch their head and say, what do they mean by that? But I think you can probably touch on that a little bit. What do they mean?
I think respect. You know, I think when we are dating, we are very respectful of our boyfriend or girlfriend. And when you get married and your spouse hurts you and they hurt you again and they do things even though you've told them, you know, I don't want you leaving the dishes on the countertop, put it in the dishwasher, and it's been now a year that they've been doing that, and these hurts accumulate, I think we lose respect and we have bad manners.
Yeah. Well, absolutely.
And I think marriages today are riddled with bad manners. That's a book I'd love to write. Good manners for marriage.
Well, absolutely. One has to ask the question, are couples prepared enough to get married? I don't want to get into the religious aspect and teachings and classes and all that sort of stuff, but should there be more guidelines and more preparation? Because just the cost of divorce, the system, the hurt to the families, the children, all the sort of stuff, and the real serious negatives that can come forward, should there be more? You hate to put regulation on something like that, but I think it's something that should be considered.
Oh, absolutely. You're very right. I think we take care of our teeth far better than we take care of our marriages. You know, we wouldn't think of waking up in the morning and going to work without having brushed our teeth. But we can leave home without connecting with our spouse. And I think couples who are dating do not realize what hard work marriage is. And I think we should be more committed as culture to these couples who take the risk of marriage, and the divorce rate, depending on what state you're in, is around 50%, then we have to come around them and give them better information, better skills, better understanding of what it means to live under the same roof with someone very different. And I think key to that is teaching them how to argue in very meaningful, constructive ways, and then following that up. I think church, if you get married in a church, I think that that church should provide counseling or at least a marriage conference every 6 months, at least, for that couple to be able to navigate their way through a very, very difficult journey, you know, marriage.
We started the interview off by mentioning Christmas and the holidays and whatever holiday that you follow, that those times and financial issues, family, death in the family, you name it. There's so many perspective reasons why one would argue, and some skeptics would say, well, if you think that you'll never argue, you're naive and it'll never happen. But that's not what you're saying here. You're saying about how to argue, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and you're right. If couples make not arguing their goal, that is dangerous, because there's a high correlation between couples who do not argue when they're dating and then do not argue in their first couple of years of marriage and divorce. Arguing is a discussion that sometimes gets heated and emotions are folded in it, and arguments actually are about two people putting their perspectives on the table and wrestling with each other's perspective to come up with what is common good for the two of them. And if you're not doing that, you will stay disconnected and you will float through life. Now, of course, there's some couples who are just so compatible and easygoing and they go with the flow. That's different than couples who don't argue, or couples who are sweeping things under the rug and placating, but they're going to build up resentfulness, which will not provide a safe place for them in the marriage.
Well, it is fascinating and it is important. Again, the book is How to Argue So Your Spouse Will Listen. There's a link on our webpage for that. Dr. Sharon Morris-May, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
And happy holidays to you.
Yes. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Bye-bye. We'll be right back with John Goodwin from the Humane Society of America. And we're going to talk about Michael Vick and the sentence that he received for dogfighting. We were going to do a follow-up segment on that. And then a little later on, Natalie Holloway's stepdad, Jug Twitty, will be here. And he and I are going to blow the lid off the investigation. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, your host, Dana Pretzer.
We are back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We're running about 5 minutes early. We're going to have John Goodwin on from the Humane Society of America. But in those next 5 minutes, I will open up the phone lines to you at 1-306-842-7884. 1-306-842-7884. So we can talk about anything you want. In a little bit, we'll have Jug Twitty, who is the stepdad of Natalie Holloway. In fact, I think we've got John calling now. You know, what got me thinking about this, and we've done several stories on animal fighting issues with folks from the Humane Society of the United States, is I heard a sports broadcaster talking about Michael Vick and Michael Vick's sentence. Of course, the NFL player, former NFL player, I hope, they're even talking about when he'll be back, sentence in court here for the charges of animal fighting. So I thought I'd invite on John Goodwin. He's the manager of animal fighting issues with the Humane Society of the United States to talk about that. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I heard this broadcaster. He does a sports show. I won't mention his name, but he wasn't making light of it, but he was almost minimizing it, saying that this is something that goes on all the time. The police basically ignore it. Vic almost got too much of a sentence, and let's wait till he gets back to the NFL. We can hardly wait. And I thought, you know, darn it, it's time that we turn the tables on this a little bit. First of all, your thoughts on the Michael Vick sentence?
Well, you know, I was pleased that he got more than what the plea bargain he had agreed to actually originally called for. The plea bargain, in exchange for him, you know, not putting up a fight and giving up information to other people, called for 12 to 18 months. The judge is a bit of an animal lover, and he gave him 23 months. So I was happy with that. And there's all this talk about him, you know, having a second chance and playing the NFL again. Well, I think you don't talk about second chances until you paid your dues.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we've talked about sentences, minimum sentences on my program now for years, and whether it's harming a child or rape, or whatever, I think there needs to be stiffer sentences for cruelty to animals. And I found the sentence, to be quite honest with you, and I understood the minimum and the judge did more, but I found the sentence provisions here almost sort of pathetic, because he's not going to serve that amount of time in jail.
Yeah, you know, and one interesting thing, the law that he violated was a federal prohibition on interstate transport of animals for fighting purposes, and that's now a federal felony. But at the time that he was doing these acts, it was a misdemeanor, because the law didn't get upgraded until May 3rd, which is like a week after the search warrant was done on his house.
Right.
Well, the feds found some sort of conspiracy law that they're able to argue he also violated, which helped us get up over what would have been a maximum 1 year prison sentence. I mean, think how bad it would have been if they hadn't been able to come up with that that conspiracy charge. I mean, he would have probably done like 8 months or something.
You know, and the perspective in the public and the media and this particular sportscaster was that the cops ignore that. In fact, the cops even go to them, and that may be true, and that's for a whole other show. But that's not the point. There's a crime committed. There's animals being harmed, and I'm curious your thoughts on behalf of the Humane Society. Is this being investigated enough? Are there enough resources out there, and is it being ignored?
Well, I think that there are more investigations underway now than there were prior to the Michael Vick case. We've gotten calls from law enforcement all over the country that's taken an interest in this, because they realize that if they raid dog fights or raid these kennels where they raise dogs for fighting, it'll be popular with the citizens in their jurisdictions. But there are still, though, other places where the cops may not get it yet, where they don't understand that, number one, these issues and these cases should be investigated because they're just horribly cruel. But number two, even if they don't care about animals, when they raid these dog fights, they're going to find a lot of people that they want to get for other things anyway. A lot of drug dealers, a lot of guys involved in other violent crimes, and the statistics bear that out. But yeah, I mean, there can always be more. We have these guys on the run. I want more resources poured into this, because I want to put dog fighting out of business in the United States for good, and I do think it's doable.
We talk about Vic, and we talk about the punishment or lack thereof, but we haven't heard much about the animals. A lot have been put down, can't be adopted out because they are trained for fighting. They're just, for lack of a better term, they're just too dangerous to do anything with. What have you heard about the status of his animals, and what can you tell us about dogs like that? Are they easily switched over, or is it hopeless once they're trained for fighting?
Well, you know, the thing is that they have, at the high-end level of dog fighting, they breed this gameness and this aggression towards other dogs into them. This desire and willingness to keep fighting other animals, even when severely injured, even on the verge of death, is artificial in canines, because canines, of course, are pack species, a pack animal. And so they breed these dogs to have this artificial level of aggression towards other animals. They're generally pretty good with people, and that's an important distinction to make, but they are just bred to really want to kill other dogs. And when Michael Vick executed all those dogs that and his co-defendants executed all those dogs that weren't demonstrating enough fighting ability. That was part of a culling program to remove dogs from their breeding program that didn't demonstrate enough aggression towards other animals and didn't fight very well. Well, you breed only the best fighters generation after generation after generation, and you end up with animals that, just as a retriever is always going to retrieve and a shepherd is always going to herd, the fighting dog's always going to want to fight other dogs. Now, of course, there can be puppies in a litter that just never turn on. That's the phrase they use. So sometimes you have animals like that that never turn on. But for the most part, fighting dogs are always going to pose a liability towards other animals.
You know, this is such a big issue, and I always ask this question of guests because I am critical of the media sometimes, but you don't, you know, besides Michael Vick, we haven't, or at least I haven't, I shouldn't speak for others, seen a lot of coverage on this issue in the media. Has the media been doing a good job with this, John?
Well, the individual dogs haven't gotten a lot of attention. And that's true. ESPN had a piece on, there were 9 beagles there that have all been, that were not used for fighting, that were all adopted out. And ESPN did one piece where they showed one of those beagles in her new home. And it was kind of a feel-good piece. But, no, I mean, of course, the attention was because, you know, Michael Vick's a big celebrity. Michael Vick's a big football player, or was a big football player, and all that.
Right.
But, you know, I do think, though, nonetheless, that the whole case did highlight how brutal dogfighting is, even if it kind of missed the individual animals at the end. And in that sense, I think that people are aware, more aware how pervasive this is and more aware how horrible it is.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better, and hopefully we, you know, we'll have more enforcement, better enforcement, and tougher laws when it comes to this. John Goodwin, manager, Animal Fighting Issues, the Humane Society of the United States, thank you for joining us, and Merry Christmas to you, sir.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, and thank you for having me.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We'll take a break, and we'll be back here in just a minute on Scared Monkeys Radio.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
I sat down this afternoon with Jug Twitty, Natalie Holloway's stepdad. Jug's been in the news here recently, commenting on the buffoonery that's been coming out of Aruba. You know, I almost said Iraq. One has to wonder if there's much difference in the governing systems of the two places. Yeah, I'm going to get criticized for that one. But you have to wonder. You know, this investigation was off and on and then off and then on and off and then on, and the arrests have been off and then on. It's like a light switch in a whorehouse. It's just unbelievable. So I sat down with Jug this afternoon, and here's what he had to say. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. In our continuing coverage of the disappearance of 18-year-old Natalie Holloway and all the all the craziness that comes out of Aruba, the misinformation, you name it, the ineptness, the reports that we see in the media, the contradictions, you name it. I thought I'd bring in someone who's very close to the whole case, Natalie's stepdad, Jug Twitty. Hi, Jug.
Hello, how are you?
I'm not too bad. Listen, just 2 seconds ago, just before we got started, I have an email here from Jossie Mansour, and I want to share it with you because I think it's important. You may know this already. He's telling me that today the prosecutor, who I call the king of the flip-flops, Moss, held a press conference and explained the so-called evidence that he based himself on as far as the rearrests go. He talks about the testimony of a girl who spoke to Yoran 5 hours after Natalie disappeared. Apparently the prosecutor talked about new technical interpretations of the laptops that were confiscated that showed a different timeline that contradicts the versions given so far by the three, and taped interviews from the brothers' home of conversations between them related to the disappearance of Natalie. And it says here, tomorrow the Kelpos apparently are holding a press press conference, and Jossie's interested to see what they have to say. And I'm also seeing a press release, Jug, from the AP that Moss talks about a electronic message. It doesn't say if it was an email or a chat room message, where one of the boys who he was refusing to say which one it was talks about that the girl is dead. Now, here we go, contradiction after contradiction after contradiction. Some big mouth lawyers in New York are going on TV saying now the case is closed and nothing will ever happen. The prosecutors are holding press conferences contradicting everything that they've said. You know, this is just nuts, for lack of a better term. What can you tell us?
Well, Dana, I've been through this now, 2.5 years?
Yeah.
And nothing surprises me. From day one, you know, they could have solved this case probably by the third, if, at least by the fifth day that we were there.
Absolutely.
We gave them all the information. We led them to the suspects. My friends and Beth's family, my family, all, you know, were the ones that were digging, giving them all the information. They just didn't act on it. And it's just a sad, sad thing. I feel so sorry for the people of Aruba, because actually, they're the ones that they have a government down there. I've never seen anybody in my life flip-flop like they do.
Oh, yeah.
These guys down there, every one of their public officials, government officials, none of them have any backbone.
No.
I mean, we could not find one single person down there that we felt like we could trust, that would help us. Jossie Mansour basically is the only person on that island that I felt that he's with, that he would help us, and that's basically because he's got the power of ink and, you know, owning the newspaper, and he's not afraid of anybody. So, if they had all this evidence, which I'm sure they did to start with, they supposedly took their laptops and everything
right
on the ninth day when they arrested the boy. So,
I find it so crazy that, they come out and they say there's new evidence, so they rearrest them. The big mouth lawyers saying that there is no new evidence, it's all old rehashed evidence, and then when they release them, the gutless prosecutor comes out and says that, well, you know, we're pretty much going to close things, we're not going to do anything now, and then the next day they come out and they say that, well, no, that's not necessarily true, these kids are still persons of interest. It's got to be so terribly frustrating for you to, you know, get a little glimmer of hope when these so-and-sos get rearrested, and then to have them kicked out, and now the contradiction keeps going again. How do you and your family cope with it? It must be terribly disappointing.
It's very disappointing. We just basically sit there and hope and pray. I mean, every time something comes up, and thank goodness to the guys that scared monkeys, and to a lot of the people like Fox News has been so, you know, good on everything. But I mean, they've kept it alive, and I think everybody down there wanted to go away. But we know that, and I've known from day one that Iran, Deepak, Satish, and Paulus Vandersloot, they all know where Natalie is or what happened to her. And I just think it's a shame that they're such cowards that if it was an accident, which I feel like it could have very well been an accident, I know several times when they interviewed me, the police down there, they kept asking me about Natalie, different questions about her, if she was epileptic, and
right,
you know, and just crazy things like that. So, you know, it very well could have been that they took her out, they put something in her drink, she flipped out, and she died.
Yeah.
But if that's the case, and I don't understand, and if they don't know anything about it, why didn't they come help Beth and I look the next morning?
Yeah, exactly.
Why did they, you know, tell us they dropped her at the Holiday Inn when they really dropped her at the beach? It just doesn't make sense.
Well, there's so many contradictions and so many lies, not only from the three suspects, but by officials, and that's the part that seems to be so frustrating. I've got a bunch of questions, Jug, from a lot of the scared monkeys, and I've got a few of my own, but what I thought I'd do before we get started with those questions, I'm going to throw some names out to you, and people that have been involved in the investigation, and I'd like to get you to maybe throw back 5 or 10 words as far as a comment goes, if you're comfortable with doing something like that.
Sure, yeah, no problem.
Okay, we talked about Jossie Mansour. Let's start with Jossie Mansour.
Okay, Jossie Mansour is a man of his word as far as I'm concerned. I've been to his house. I've met his wife. I know his sons actually went to military school at the same place I went to military school. You know, I trust him. He was always there to help. And he stands up for himself, and he's really trying to stand up for the Aruba.
The complete opposite spectrum as far as media goes in Aruba, Juliet Renfro.
Well, Juliet, you know, she has her own agenda and her whole deal the whole time down there. I think she ran us around in circles. She probably has some connection to Paulus Vandersloot, and she was trying to lead us away during those 9 days so they'd have time to cover their tracks. So she's strictly in it for her name to be out there.
My next name, Paulus Vandersloot.
Paulus Vandersloot is a coward. I've never, you know, I'm a father. I have two children. I consider myself a very good father. This man is not. And, you know, I was with him face to face, and I still see his face at night when I go to sleep sometimes because the man's evil.
Dennis Jacobs.
Dennis Jacobs is a puppet. He's dirty. I could tell the first day that we went over there, and you've heard the cornflake story and
yep.
stuff that like that, but that's all true. The man's being, his strings are being pulled by somebody up top.
Gerald Dompig.
Don't know Gerald Dompig that much. He came in later, and I never really sat down face to face with him.
And the Prime Minister of Aruba.
Odebear?
Yep.
Very wishy-washy. You know, sat with Beth and I, and we felt like when we had dinner with him and his wife, and we gave him some information that we had confidential, we thought, and, you know, that he was just flabbergasted by it and would do something about it, but he obviously doesn't have power down there either.
It seems like an island that coined the term puppet, that the government are puppets, there's so much control that goes on down there. I'm going to ask you this question, and maybe you can answer, maybe you can't. I've covered this story now for 2.5 years. The folks at Scared Monkeys, like you say, Fox News, you name it. And we've pretty much gone over everything. You're going to see some of these questions that I'm going to ask you, that there are a lot of knowledgeable people out there. But is there one thing, Jug, that maybe you'd like to say that we've never heard or seen or read about this investigation?
I don't know that there's one thing. I will say that, and I've said all along, that I think that Vonderstraaten is there, somehow or another, he's connected to Paulus, and he was the whole reason that they didn't solve the case immediately. I think that, and I know for a fact because I sat down in a private meeting with him after I was privy to read some police interrogation reports that he didn't know I'd read, and asked him a specific question about Iran when he was with Natalie that night, and about some of the things he said about what she was wearing, the color of her underwear. And he said, he never said that. There's no way he said that. Well, I knew right then that he was covering up that part of it, because I just read it, and he read the same thing because he was sitting in an interrogation. So, I knew then, and I told Beth, I said, this is not good. I mean, this guy is bad. He's dirty. And I don't know, you know, if there are judges involved in it, but this case should have been solved early on, of course. And there's a lot of people down there that know, but I think they're just too afraid to come out because they have to live on that island.
Yeah, exactly. I've interviewed Art Wood on this program many times, and spoken to the late Jamie Skeeters many times, and Clint Van Zandt, all the investigators that, you know, don't have any authority in Aruba, but and myself being in law enforcement as long as I have. It's such a simple case that could have been dealt with so early. To see it this long now, it absolutely makes you sick. One more question before we get to the questions from the monkeys, and I want to, again, thank you for popping on here, Jug. We see a New York lawyer, I don't even like saying his name, but I'm going to mention it anyway, Joe Tacopina, that is on the cable news channels on a nightly basis sometimes, keeps representing himself as Joran's attorney. Yet the contradictions I hear from Aruba is that he's not Joran's Aruban attorney, but the cable shows keep showing him as the only lawyer involved. What do you think, and that's the last name I'm going to throw out to you, about Joe Tacopina?
Typical New York lawyer, and I think that, you know, the people in America recognize the same thing. He's just real smart aleck, and he's jumping on it again so that he can get his name out there, so he can be seen. And you know, it's a lawyer's job to represent their client, and he would only represent a PRN, I guess, if he was in the United States.
Right, right. And I just find it disappointing how the cable news shows cater to him, but that's a whole other story for another time. Let's get to some questions. We're down to about 15 minutes left here with Jug Twitty. You know, and I know, that there's a search that's going to take place. We can only hope and pray that it comes up successful. But one of the questions here that I have from some of our listeners, it says, do you have a theory on where Natalie's body was disposed of and who assisted in the disposal of that body?
I don't have a theory. I can say that something did happen. You know, when we met there that night, and when we went to the Vandersloot's house, and they followed us with the police back to the Holiday Inn where supposedly they had dropped him off, Yoron kept telling me and telling the police that, you know, we dropped her off right here, and when she got out of the car, she stumbled and she hit her head. And that stumbling or hitting her head, kind of, I've heard so many different stories. I know my friends went to the headmaster of the school where Yoron went the second day, and the headmaster said something there about, you know, she may have hit her head on the rocks while she was watching the sharks or something. And this hitting her head keeps coming up and coming up. So, my theory would be, one of them would be that they gave her something, she reacted to it, flipped out or something, got in a bad situation. She probably tried to fight her way out of it. She may have fallen out of the car. She may have fallen, hit her head or something like that. But as far as what they did with the body, I don't know. I mean, but obviously they did something that, if Paulus is going to say, you know, no body, no case.
Yeah, absolutely. Another question here says, there were several reports that blood was observed in Deepak's car by the Aruban law enforcement members, and even the Prime Minister said there was blood in the car. Did you see anything in the car that night when you arrived at the Vandersloot's?
Okay, now, that's one thing that I always say, and, you know, and I'll talk to Beth, if I had one chance, you know, to do anything different, I wish as many people as we had, because I had an entourage there that came down with Beth and I, and we had that car surrounded. I just wish I had opened that trunk, because I know there was some evidence in there. I will tell you, there's an officer down there, and his name is Eric Sumers, I think is his name, and he told me that there was fluid in the headliner of the car, of Deepak's car. That's another piece of evidence I guarantee you got buried somewhere. It's hidden, but you know, and they had so much time to clean that car, but I still think there's evidence in that car.
Actually, that takes us right to the next question. It says, I know there were police officers there initially helping you with information. How much did you learn from them, and who do you think eventually shut them up?
There again, I mean, it's so hard to figure out, because I kept asking them, you know, the officers that we went and got that night to go to Yoron's house, you know, we went and got the police, but we didn't just drive up to his house. But of course, they're speaking Papiamento, which I can't understand.
Right.
And I'm thinking, well, you know, they're asking him the right questions and everything. But the thing that really floored me is they never went back and asked those policemen, I mean, till way later on in the investigation, what actually went on that night. And there was no police record, supposedly, of them going over there and talking to Paulus Vandersloot, you know, so with us. I mean, it's crazy. You know there are records, but somehow or another, now there's not records.
One of the theories that, and Art Wood considers it to be more than a theory, is that this Coon, I forget how you say his last name, Gottenboos or whatever, his boat was used to take Natalie out to sea. And the question here says, do you think that boat was used to take Natalie out to sea?
It very well could have been. You know, something, you know, she's not on that island, I don't think. The only other thing that could have happened is, you know, possibly is, they do have the incinerator there, you know, and I talked to Beth about that, and that definitely you wouldn't have any remains or anything that you could find. But the only other thing would be if she got off the island somehow or another, which I don't believe that could have happened, then they probably did do something in the water.
We've gone over this aspect of the investigation several times and looked at it from all angles, but I'll ask you, do you believe that Natalie was taken to their house, the Vandersloot house, and do you believe that the body might have been there the night you were there? You talked about the trunk.
Yes, I do. I mean, I definitely believe she was taken to that house, and I believe that if she wasn't in that house, she was close. Because when they came back that night, you know, we pulled up there, and Paulus was there, but the boys weren't there. And this was like 3:30 in the morning. He said they were at the casino gambling courses of school night.
Right.
He calls them on their cell phone.
Yeah.
Says they're at the casino. We all rush over there, and big entourage with the police and everything, go in there. They're not there. We look all around. He calls them back. Paulus calls Yaron back on the cell phone and said, "Where are you? I thought you were here." He said, "Well, I thought you wanted me to come home." So we get home. We go back to their house, and they're all sweaty, and they hadn't been to a casino, I guarantee you. So they were that was probably when it happened. They were getting Natalie maybe out of that house or whatever.
Well, exactly. It was a warning, a heads up, and that whole story is phony as a $3 bill that was coming out of those characters. But the next question is a combination of questions I have here and one of mine as far as the FBI involvement and the government of the United States, Alabama, whatever. Have you received enough assistance from your own government helping with this?
Well, you know, Dan, we did in the beginning. I mean, the FBI was there, a couple of FBI agents I really got to know real well, and I truly believe they were there to help us, but there was nothing they could do. I mean, there absolutely was nothing, because the Reuben government, every time they would get in a meeting down there, they would start speaking in Papiamento, and even the FBI agents were telling me, "I don't understand what they're saying." And I'm going, well, why don't we send somebody down here that does understand what they're saying?
Exactly.
And they were sent there strictly to observe. They couldn't, you know, they couldn't really offer anything in the investigation.
Have you been told, is there an appeal process or anything more that you can do? Again, it's so contradictory as far as what actually has happened here in the last little while, but as far as keeping the case open or keeping these suspects as suspects, or have you heard?
I don't know, Dana. Justice system down there is so screwed up.
Yep.
It's just unbelievable. I would bet you that 75% of the people on that island don't even understand it. I mean, it's almost like they change their laws to fit their needs. It is so hard to follow what they do. And I, honest to God, I believe that if they, you know, found Natalie's body, even with this search boat or whatever, unless you could find, you know, a video showing Yaron, Deepak, and Satish doing something to her, they still wouldn't, you know, convict them of it.
Exactly. You know, you could have that smoking gun, so to speak, and they'd still find an excuse to screw it up. There's been so much talk about drug involvement. There's been some high-profile media people saying that they have informants telling them that Natalie died of a drug overdose, all this sort of nonsense with, you know, no body, no proof. I don't know how they can report that. But what have you been told as far as, you know, the rumors of drug involvement with these characters? We've all speculated, and I agree with you, that there was probably a drink tampered with. There's even been talk about the porn industry being involved in this cover-up. What can you tell us about that?
Now, I don't know about that. I know Natalie, you know, was not into drugs at all. Natalie was really a goody two-shoes, if you want to know the truth, more so than probably 90% of those kids that were on that trip. And I know how those kids act. My son went on the same trip 2 years prior to that, and my nephews were on that trip too. But, you know, I don't think there's any way Natalie was involved with the drugs down there. I think that they could have put something in her drink, and like I said, that's why they kept questioning me as to what her medical history was, because I think somebody has told them that, you know, she flipped out.
Right.
She took something, or they gave her something or something, she flipped out. So,
you know, one of the questions that comes up, you mentioned it earlier, and I agree with you completely. Obviously, someone knows something, whether it's the three boys who know everything or someone else as far as a witness goes. Is there still a reward available? Is there a way that we can keep putting pressure on to try and get that witness to come forward?
You know, I don't know, Dan. I mean, you know, the reward got up to, what, $1 million?
Yeah.
Or even more, probably, and we thought for sure that would, you know, bring something. Of course, it brought out people just looking for money, but I don't know. I just truly believe that it's got to be a lot bigger than everybody thinks it is. It must go way to the top because it is so hush-hush. I would have almost bet anything that, you know, by this time that somebody would have said something because it's such a small island. But and you know that they have to know about it. I mean, you yeah, know absolutely. That Deepak and Satish and all those guys know what happened to Natalie.
Absolutely.
I don't know if they're too scared to say it. And like I said, it could very well have been an accident, but... I just don't know how nobody has said anything.
Yeah,
I don't think they put enough pressure on, to be honest with you, but
they haven't worked hard enough on it, that's for sure.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. But and you may not be able to answer this question too, but when Beth and Dave went down recently, just after they were told that the boys had been rearrested, to meet with the prosecutor, there's a lot of press reports and a lot of, again, misinformation from some of the media people we talked about earlier, that Beth was interrogated, they used the term, while she was there for 4 hours about Natalie. Has Beth told you anything about that meeting that they had?
She's talked to me about it. We talked about it last night. But, I mean, it's nothing like that she was interrogated. All she said was that the prosecutor basically lied to them and, you know, told them they had this new evidence and then got down there and that Beth and Dave sat there with him for 4 hours and asked him questions and he wouldn't answer any of them. So
it's... one person that's involved, so to speak, as far as media reports go, and we see all the time, is Anita Vandersloot, and some of the comments that she made to Beth in the early stages of this were just absolutely, you know, would raise the hair on the back of your neck. But I'm curious your thoughts on her involvement and whether or not she knows anything about what went on.
No, I'm sure she knows something. I'm you know, and again, she's just there to, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure Paulus and Urine both, you know, control her. And I don't know how she can live with it in her, you know, herself, but she's a very weak person.
You know, here we're a few days away from Christmas, 2.5 years later, more than that now, difficulty in yours and Beth's and Dave's personal lives, all that sort of stuff. I'm not going to get into that because really it's nobody's business.
Yeah, I understand.
But it's here we are now, again, all this time later. At Christmas time is probably one of the most difficult times. And I ask family members all the time of missing loved ones, here it is Christmas again, you have no answers. And it's kind of a dumb question on my part, but your thoughts and your feelings about Natalie not being there.
Well, it's really hard because Natalie was a great girl. She I mean, I loved her to death, and I love Matt to death, her brother. But you know, I think, Dan, this whole thing, Aruba is a sad place because whoever's down there is pulling all these strings. They're orchestrating this deal. I mean, you know, for him to come out and say he has all this new evidence right before Thanksgiving.
Right.
I remember the day it happened, you know, and Beth's mother was here in town, and, you know, to get everybody's hopes up and everything, and then, you know, go down there, and then he won't answer any questions, and then it's almost like, you know, they say they're going to close the investigation the day the boat's coming over there to start doing the searching, and it's all timing. I mean, you know, I came out and said something in the AP and everything, and then all of a sudden... I did a couple of interviews, and they came back and said, well, we're not closing the investigation. No, hold on a second. You know, so
exactly.
It's just unbelievable to me.
Well, it's a head-scratcher for sure. And listen, I want to wish you and your family all the best for the holiday season. And you know that me and my audience supports you 1,000%. And any time we can do anything for you, just let us know.
And I appreciate that, Dan, and I appreciate all the scared monkeys, because honestly, that's the way I keep of it. I never post on there, but trust me, I know every one of the people that do. I mean, I read every one of the comments, and I appreciate the help, because that has helped Beth very much.
All right.
You have a happy holiday yourself.
Merry Christmas to you, my friend.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right, that's Jug Twitty. We'll be right back. And we are right back. And, you know, Jug says that there's a lot of strings being pulled in Aruba. He's right. There's more strings being pulled there than an episode of The Muppet Show. And there's a lot of puppets on that one. I'm going to take 5 minutes and take some calls. I think that was a pretty poignant interview And I'm curious what you have to say. 1-306-842-7884. 1-306-842-7884. You can call in now and we can talk about that or anything else you want. It's, you know, you can hear in Jug's voice and in the way he answers how direct, how completely, honestly he answered those questions and how he feels and how he is able to answer those questions. Hey, stepdad or not, that doesn't matter. When you love somebody, you love somebody. It's just fascinating. It's fantastic that he was able to come on the show, but it is also so sad that this family still does not have the answers, and we're going to work real hard to do what we can. The king of the flip-flops, prosecutor, all those strings being pulled, the loudmouth lawyers and all these pinheads over there that think that they change their minds more there than most people change their socks, and it's just absolutely sickening. That little girl needs to be found. That little girl needs to be brought home to Alabama and laid to rest. And will there ever be justice in that that crock pot of an island? I don't know, but they need to find that little girl first. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Dana, my friend, how are you this evening?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Happy. Can we say Merry Christmas on Scared Monkeys Radio? I think I did. Or is it Happy Holidays?
No, I think we're allowed to say Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and what is it, the Boxing Day.
Absolutely, absolutely. I interviewed Jug this afternoon, and I should mention, I've been neglectful here, that we had planned to have Jossie Mansour on tonight, but he wasn't able to come on at the last minute. His wife reminded him that he had some place to go, and we did the interview with the lady who wrote the book about how to argue successfully with your spouse, and we certainly didn't want to get Jossie in any trouble, but we'll have him back on. But I'm curious your thoughts on the Jug Twitty interview.
Well, Danny, I can certainly relate to the Jossie thing, that's for sure.
And yeah, me too.
I forgive him entirely, because if it wasn't for my wife pointing me in the right direction, I wouldn't know which end was up either.
Yeah, that's true.
Jug, it's been a long time in coming that Jug had his opportunity to get out there and really say something. And it's amazing to hear somebody be as forthright,
right,
with what he's saying. I mean, we're so used to this story where we never know which end is up. We're always told misinformation. We're told one thing one day, and next thing it's another thing the next day, because they probably read something online and get blasted out of the water down there in Aruba and wonder why on earth they said what they said in the first place. But what Jug said, in many respects, I mean, we go back and we remember what Jug said a long, long time ago about how corrupt and what was going on down there. And the family's tongues were tied for a very, very long time, because Aruba played a really sick game with this family of basically a form of extortion, that unless you play nice with us, we're not going to help look for your daughter. And we all know they had no intentions of really looking for Natalie. This thing, because no one can be this inept and stupid.
No,
I mean, honestly, Dana. I mean, you've been in law enforcement, for a number of years. Nobody can be this stupid. It is a calculated thing what they did, and it all tends to make sense when you start to hear when Jug had mentioned. The police talked about, did Natalie have epilepsy? So then you think of seizures, and you think, okay, so what do they know that they're not telling everybody? Somebody obviously, somewhere said that she went into a seizure, she went into convulsions, something happened. Now, if this was a accident, those three boys would have just left her on the beach like they claimed they did.
Right.
They would have just left her on the beach. She would have died of an accidental overdose, and she would have been found the next day, and she would have just been a poor, unfortunate high school teenager who partied too much and who died of an accidental overdose.
Right.
But that isn't what happened, because you don't get rid of a body if it was just an accident. However, you do get rid of a body when you don't want forensic evidence found, and you don't want marks to be found on a body, or a sexual assault, or a toxicology report that shows that, you know, these reports of cocaine were really date rape drugs. That makes more sense, and that's what none of these people got. I mean, they think that everyone is like the stupidest person in the world just because, I guess, they are. That they live in this, I don't know what it is, I mean, I don't even know what to say. It's that they live in this childish bubble down there where they think that nobody really thinks for themselves, because they squelch their people so much that they think that, I don't know, that the rest of the world was just going to ignore this.
Yeah, I know, exactly. And, you know, I think our hopes are right now, and we all pray that that little girl will be found and they can bring her home. What will happen otherwise at that so-called island is totally beyond you and I, and the stories change, and they change, and then they change again, and it's so sickening. It makes it even difficult to talk about.
I mean, Dana, I have many a conversation with people all the time who have no idea that I am Red from Scared Monkeys.
Right.
And they talk about Aruba, and they state the fact that they would never go there. They wonder why this kind of stuff happens, and they basically say to me, why on earth am I going to spend my money in a place where they, if God forbid something happens to me, they're going to cover up my crime?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's really the truth of this. It's not that a crime actually happened, because, you know, unfortunately crimes happen in Canada, they happen in the U.S., they happen in Aruba. I mean, but you know what? We try to investigate these crimes and bring the criminals to justice. And, you know, Jug made some comments tonight that, you know, this case was completely solvable.
Yeah.
It was a situation where they chose not to. And it was obvious from the very beginning that the fix was in, from the very standpoint of when they gave them the runaround about going from the house to the casino back to the house. I mean, they were doing it from day one.
Yeah,
and, you know, you look at this, and, you know, with the news reports coming out today with the press conference by Moss of, you know, making the comment that one of the suspects said she was dead. I mean, Dana, I mean, what do they, I mean, now they go, oh, well, no, we need a body to prove that she's dead.
Yeah,
no, you don't. Yeah. When you have a suspect making a reference to the person is dead, well, guess what? Why would they ever make that comment? Why on earth, if they just left somebody somewhere and she was alive, would you ever reference she's dead?
It's a culpable statement for sure. You know, I don't know, and I know, and you know that we'll keep following this story till there's a conclusion. And you and I may be old men in wheelchairs, but we'll keep plugging away.
I mean, you really have to, you know, especially being the Christmas season, and the game that you made reference to it tonight.
Yeah.
The game that they played of basically screwing this family around again during the Thanksgiving Christmas time of building up hope, saying that there was stuff, and then saying that there was nothing, and then in turn basically saying that, oh no, they're not suspects anymore, but they're people of interest. I mean, what in the hell is that about? I mean, how on earth do you think someone is, there was no rule that said that they had to be taken off as being suspects. That was just, you know, more damage control, because these people have got to be, you know, on the PR side, they're about one of the most inept bunch of bastards I think I've ever come across in my life. I don't know who the hell is giving them any form of advice. They may want to, like, actually find some new people to, like, help lie for them. The stupidity, you know, in that kind of thing is just absolutely amazing, that they can continually put their foot in their mouth, you know, and change, you know, everything You know, and like I said, this goes on in Aruba every single day. They're used to it. This is obviously systemic down there. and Judd makes a good point. You know, he feels sorry for the Aruban people. And, you know, I guess we have to, but by the same token, my God, you think somebody could come forward? You think somebody could say something? I mean, even Joe Tacopino has said, you know, everybody knows everybody on the island. Mm-hmm. It's just absolutely amazing that it has come to this. And, you know, somebody making a comment of somebody being, it doesn't really mean anything. Mm.
No. Yeah,
I guess.
Exactly. Well said, as usual. Thank you, my friend.
Okay, Dana, you have a very Merry Christmas.
Same to you. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye. And we'll keep the phone line open for about another 4 minutes if you want to sneak in a quick call, 1-306-842-7884. I won't keep you on long, 1-306-842-7884. I want to thank all my guests tonight and again remind you that our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live, pick up the daily commentary, pick up shows from the past, download them, play them, podcast them, do whatever you have to do, make comments about them. The show is there for you. That's scaredmonkeysradio.com. Again, 1-306-842-7884. Did you enjoy the interview with Jug Twitty tonight? Did you think we were both out to lunch? What are your thoughts? You know, this story keeps changing and changing and changing, yet there's never any answers, and that's the part that has to be so frustrating and so upsetting. And, you know, there's a lot of sincere emotion out there from people on both sides on how they feel about the case, how it's been handled, how it's been portrayed in the media, and how people have looked at it. It's a high-profile case for sure. We've seen books and had on guests. And again, let's take all that aside, and who knows if there'll ever be justice in Aruba. I don't know. But when the time comes, I hope that the family can lay their little girl to rest where she belongs, and so she can rest in peace. And part of this nightmare will be put aside, because it's just gone on too long. This case could have been solved right away, and we can keep doing story after story after story about it, but it just never seems to end. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Dana. This is Cliff in Washington, D.C. Big fan of your show.
Thank you, sir.
I've been listening tonight, and I had a question relating to some of the documents you've pulled together on your website.
Mm-hmm.
The transcripts, I think, are very revealing in this case, and I just wanted to know, and you may have gone over this on your show before, but what is the source of those documents, if you can say that, if it was someone from inside the police department down there that, made photocopies, released them to Diario, or is there a known source for the documents, or can you speak to that?
You know, to be quite honest with you, I can't speak to that because the blog, the Scared Monkeys blog themselves, are somewhat of a different entity than what I am, although... You can look at it two ways. You can look at very many high-profile cases and wonder, how does this stuff get leaked in the first place? And then you can also say it's good that it is, so people can see what's really going on, even if the answers aren't out there.
Right. And it's amazing if you look through them, just the contradictions in the suspect statements.
Oh, yeah.
But I did want to see, you know, if there was any confirmation on the authenticity of them, or if, as you said, it's kind of a self-populating universe of information. So
it sure is. Anything else I can do for you?
No, that's it. Thanks a lot, Dana. Great show.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Bye-bye. 1-306-842-7884. You know, when you look at, I'm going from the law enforcement perspective here, and then I'll go from the talk show perspective. Leaks to the media of documents shouldn't happen. But then you have to look at that it's inevitable, it's going to happen, and it's a way for people to find out what's really going on. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, this is the Scared Monkey Show.
You bet it is.
I wanted to make a comment about the issue of the king of the flip-flops in terms of the prosecutor.
I use that term, yeah.
From what I understand is the AP story that originally came out was absolutely wrong.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Okay.
And that what the story was filed by a reporter on the island and rewritten in the state, and it was wrong, and the prosecutor cleared it.
Okay.
Now, I think sometimes a lot of the information that you all go off of is erroneous reporting.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, that's entirely true. In some cases, but you also have to look at what some people who have been directly involved have said, what they've been told by the prosecutor or by people in the Justice Department, and then how the next day they can certainly change their mind. But yeah, there has been erroneous reporting, and we'll be the first ones to admit that when it happens. Thanks for calling. 1-306-842-7884. Sure, things can get mixed up. But yeah, that prosecutor has been the king of the flip-flops. That's my term. He comes forward and says things, and then the next day says something different. And that's not just come from wire reports. That's come from reports from all over the place, including people who have spoken to him directly. We got about 30 seconds left, so sneak in a quick call, and I'll take a quick comment from you. If not, we'll finish up. I'm not sure when the next show will be. It will be after Christmas, so I want to wish you all a Merry Christmas, if that's the holiday that you celebrate. And I remind you to make sure and check out our webpage at scaredmonkeysradio.com for our daily commentary. And our next show will be after Christmas sometime. And stay tuned to the webpage for exactly when. Thanks for listening. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.